It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The first funerals for victims of Saturday's Tree of Life Synagogue shooting will take place at noon today. Services will be held for 59-year-old Cecil Rosenthal and his 54-year-old brother David, who were beloved by their congregation. The man accused of killing the Rosenthals and nine others was arraigned yesterday before a federal magistrate in Pittsburgh. We're going to discuss the case, including the possibility of the death penalty, with WESA reporter Arnlee Herring and WESA's legal analyst David Harris, who's a Squirrel Hill resident, as well as a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Hi, Kevin. Good to be with you.
Arnlee, I'm going to start with you. You attended the federal arraignment yesterday of the suspect, 46-year-old Robert Bowers. If you would, describe the scene for us.
The courtroom was packed with reporters and lawyers for the most part. And of course, the focus of all their attention was the defendant, Robert Bowers, who is accused of committing the attack on the Tree of Life Synagogue. He was escorted in by U.S. Marshals. He was wearing handcuffs, was shackled, and a blue sweatshirt, gray sweatpants. Looked quite ordinary by many indicators. Mm-hmm. He sat quietly for the most part. He spoke very softly with his lawyers initially, and the judge essentially just read his charges to him, asked him if he understood them, whether he wanted to be appointed a federal public defender. And it was a very short session. Bowers gave very short yes, no answers. I think yes for the most part, spoke very clearly. So in many ways, it was a very ordinary proceeding.
And he had just been recently, very recently, released from the hospital.
That's right. He was sitting in a wheelchair. He suffered gunshot wounds in a shootout with police.
Okay. Did his demeanor match the... You said he was quiet. It didn't seem to match the rage in which he allegedly perpetrated the crimes and even... from his social media postings, et cetera.
That, to me, was the most striking thing about the whole affair. He was very passive and quiet and really kind of what you would expect in most hearings like this.
David, so we get an understanding. The arraignment, is
yes.
this a formality? What is it in the process of the case going forward?
The arraignment is in many jurisdictions called something like first appearance. Mm-hmm. Once a person gets arrested, when a person is arrested, a police officer has made a decision that there's probable cause to believe a crime's been committed and this person is involved. And we have to quickly get the person in front of a judge, a neutral person, to make the same kind of finding. We then would move on to other proceedings within the early part of the case. But the very first thing that happens is an arraignment where a person is advised of these are the charges against you. Do you have a lawyer? Do you want to be represented? If you can't afford a lawyer, we'll appoint the public defender to screen you and look to see if they will represent you.
And on late public defenders at this point are representing him, or at least represented him at the arraignment. Was that the case?
Yes, there were two federal public defenders there, and they have not actually been appointed to represent Bowers, but the office at this point and from the beginning has been representing him.
Okay. So a preliminary hearing is scheduled for Thursday morning. David, what usually transpires at a preliminary hearing? Is this just sort of all prosecution setting it up?
The function of a preliminary hearing is to make a determination of whether there is probable cause to hold the defendant for trial. It is not proof positive. It is not a trial. It is a preliminary proceeding to determine whether there's enough evidence to go forward. In a preliminary hearing, the prosecution would present evidence. They can do so through one police officer or one agent, just enough to show a probability that a crime was committed and that this person is probably involved, that there is a suspect, and that the case should go forward. It's a standard proceeding. The standard of evidence is fairly low. The prosecution will do this and present its first evidence. It doesn't have to be a lot, just enough for probable cause.
Also, the U.S. attorney, Scott Brady, who is leading this prosecution, noted yesterday that starting yesterday, his office had 30 days to present the evidence to a grand jury, which then would indict Bowers.
Right. I often see cases where preliminary hearings are waived. Is there any sense that that might be the case Thursday when the preliminary hearing is scheduled for Bowers?
There's been no indication yet, and Mr. Brady has indicated they're prepared to go forward and present evidence this week at the preliminary hearing. But you're right that that does get done sometimes. The jurisdiction I worked in years ago, it was either a preliminary hearing or a grand jury. Didn't have to do both. So state and federal practices do vary. But from what we know now, Brady is planning to go forward with preliminary hearing this week.
All right. I noticed that there were two assistant U.S. attorneys at yesterday's arraignment, Sue Song and Troy Rivetti. Is that unusual, too? I mean, because Scott Brady said we're going to throw everything into this case. Is that unusual, do we know?
Not unusual. What you have to know about those two individuals is they are among the highest-ranking people in that office. Sue Song was the first assistant under previous U.S. Attorney David Hickton. I believe she's still in that position now. I don't know for sure. And Troy Rivetti is also a veteran. So it was a way of showing we've got our best and most experienced people on the job.
So Bowers is charged with more than two dozen federal counts. To both of you, is the state sort of, I mean, there are state charges as well. Is the state acquiescing? Is it common for the state to let the feds take the lead in this case because these charges that he was arraigned on yesterday were strictly federal charges? Is that correct?
That's right. And this isn't unusual in a case like this. The state will stand down and let the federal prosecution play out. There's no indication when the state would start proceedings, but that's a pretty standard practice when you have parallel prosecutions like this.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The feds want to take the lead here because they can go ahead. They can get even death verdicts if they so choose, and if the jury approves. And it wouldn't be unusual for the state to then decide whether it will go ahead with its charges after the federal proceedings are done.
And it's possible that, say, at the federal level, a jury decides not to sentence Bowers to death.
That's right.
The state could then step in and say, we want to pursue the death penalty.
But one thing the federal prosecutors are doing, they're pursuing it as a hate crime. And David, Pennsylvania does not have a hate crimes law per se to file under, or do that?
Only you can correct me. I think they do have a hate crime statute of a sort, but the federal government can pursue it this way. It brings the FBI right in. It brings in all the resources. So there are good reasons to bring federal charges.
In Pennsylvania, those hate crime statutes are referred to as ethnic intimidation statutes. And the way they function is they serve as in what's called an enhancement. So if you're convicted of homicide, the sentence then would be enhanced to what the next degree's sentence would be.
And that ethnic, you use the term ethnic, would that apply to a religious group? In this case, the victims were all Jewish.
It would.
Okay. David, so is there a specific definition of a hate crime?
Well, within the federal law, what they're looking for this time around is interfering with the federal constitutional right to practice one's religion and killing somebody in that context. And so that is the federal crime that is being brought here on behalf of these victims. The general idea of a hate crime is that you use the motivation of the person to show that it is not a regular crime. There is, of course, murder and homicide, but if motivated by religious, ethnic, or racial hatred, the judgment of the Congress, and it could be a state legislature, has been that this is a much more serious crime. We want to make a separate kind of statement to show that this is something we will protect and will not tolerate.
Unley, you spoke with Heidi Byrick yesterday on behalf of the Confluence. She's with the Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors hate crimes around the nation.
Now, one other realm that gets some attention right now is the online space, where even on mainstream platforms like Facebook, you can find so much hate of various forms. And I think the tech companies in Silicon Valley have a big responsibility here to try to tone that down, because it is all too easy for someone to post, you know, anti-Semitic, racist materials online to influence other people, and to get them, you know, ultimately ginned up enough to commit acts of violence like we saw in Pittsburgh. And so that kind of material has got to be reduced online, or we're just going to be exposing too many people to this stuff.
All right. Byrick said tech companies have a big responsibility regarding the posting of anti-Semitic and racist materials. To each of you, is that a moral responsibility, or is there a legal responsibility here?
There isn't a legal responsibility. When we talk about legal responsibilities, we're usually talking about the government, or we're talking about some statute that's been passed that says you must do X. And at this point, the tech companies don't have a legal responsibility, but their platforms are being used in ways that foment hate and, as we can see, incite violence.
There's been some concern in this conversation around social media and what responsibility they have, that there are free speech rights at stake. And I asked Heidi about this, and she said that that really doesn't apply here because it wouldn't be the government restricting speech. These are private enterprises. They can set the ground rules for how their platforms are used.
Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I think there is confusion oftentimes when we talk about free speech rights or censorship or something like that. The government is prohibited from interfering with free speech except when it is directly inciting violence. When you're talking about private companies that have these platforms, which are quite powerful and pervasive, the issue is not the same. It isn't about government censorship. It's about responsibility to society and how your product gets used.
And Pursuant, you mentioned the death penalty, whether it's the federal or Onley gave the alternative if the state decides to do it, if the feds choose not to. But still, at the state level, isn't pursuing the death penalty kind of complicated? There is a moratorium right now.
Well, at the state level, there is a moratorium, and it's not clear that if there was a state death verdict that it would ever be carried out. It certainly wouldn't be carried out now, and we know that the timeline for carrying out a death penalty is quite long, even without a moratorium being in place. The federal government can bring a death penalty case, too. They seldom do it because the action in the criminal sphere is really on the state level. It just doesn't happen that often, but we can all remember Tim McVeigh being executed by the federal government, too, so it can be done.
For the Oklahoma City federal building.
That's right.
And very quickly, I've about a minute left. I wanted to ask you, on Sunday, Onley, you attended the news briefing on Sunday morning, and Scott Brady, the U.S. attorney, was asked about what about filing charges regarding an act of terrorism. What did he say? And I want to talk a little bit about that.
He said his office is looking into that. At this point, they're not ready to bring those charges. He said that it can be hard to make that case in this situation, potentially because it involves Bowers trying to propagate some ideology beyond committing a hate crime that is fueled by bias against Jewish people. So that's something his office is weighing, but they haven't come to a conclusion.
Would that, David, his postings on social media, could they sort of build that into he's trying to propagate something and in support of a group of people who are anti-Semitic, are haters?
Well, anytime you go into putting together a set of charges, you're looking for the most serious charges that the evidence can support. He's clearly got a hate crimes case here, and he's going after that first, which is completely appropriate, to go the next step and show that that information supports a coherent sort of ideology would be another thing entirely. So he's wise to think about it and really look at his evidence.
WESA reporter Onley Herring, David Harris, WESA's legal analyst and host of the Criminal Injustice Podcast. Thank you so very much.
Thank
My
you.
Pleasure, Kevin.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Any musician would be thrilled to have created a gold record. That's when more than 500,000 copies of an album are sold. Double that and you've gone platinum. Multiply that by 10 and you've reached diamond status, the rarest of rare feats in the music world. That's where the rankings ended until Thriller. Michael Jackson's epic sixth record sold so many copies that a new designation had to be created. On this day in 1984, Thriller was the first album to be certified double diamond with sales of over 20 million copies, a record that nobody touched for 10 years. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Words of reflection, grief, and condolences have covered the pages of newspapers across the country in the aftermath of the mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Squirrel Hill. Among them is David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. David grew up in Boston, but made his Pittsburgh home three blocks from the synagogue. He ran home when the sirens began to wail, and has since mourned alongside his city through a pair of editorials. He joins me now in the WESA studios. David, what made you want to write?
I got up at 5 a.m. to write this because I was too tired not to write.
What was it you wanted to get out, both within the pages of your own newspaper and in the New York Times?
It was my impulse and my duty to do what we were put on this earth to do as journalists, and that is to tell the truth and to share the pain and to share the experience.
Here's David Shribman reading his own editorial published in the New York Times on Sunday. Anti-Semitism comes to a city of tolerance. My wife is Polish Catholic from Buffalo. I am a Jew from Boston. In Pittsburgh, we found remarkable religious harmony that one terrible act of violence will not break. David, when you're ready.
More than a third of this city is Catholic. The bishop always interrupts his midnight mass processional, stopping at the seventh row from the altar every Christmas Eve to give a hug to the rabbi, whose synagogue is down the street from the cathedral. There are six kosher food establishments in a two-block area of town. Yet the city's signature sandwich is an unkosher mess of meat and coleslaw with fries mashed atop the glop. The garment of choice every Friday before a Steelers game is a black and gold Ben Roethlisberger or Antonio Brown shirt. Hours later, at sundown, the streets are full of Jewish men in the black garb of the Orthodox and the observant on their solemn march to Sabbath prayer. And so, in the eternal mix of irony and tragedy that is the human story, an anti-Semitic rampage at the Tree of Life Synagogue has inflicted deep wounds on perhaps the least anti-Semitic city in the country. Here, Jewish and Protestant clergy swapped pulpits amid the 19th century soot of the Industrial Revolution. Here, in the year after the 1892 Homestead Steel Strike, Rosh Hashanah services were conducted in the club room of the Volunteer Fire Company's engine house down the street from where union activists and Pinkerton agents conducted one of the bloodiest labor battles in American history. Here, in 1885, the tensions between identity and assimilation took their form in perhaps the most important document of Reform Judaism, the Pittsburgh Platform. And here, last year, David Zubik, the Catholic Bishop of Pittsburgh, and Aaron Bisnow, the rabbi at Motive Shalom Congregation, boarded a plane together at Pittsburgh International and led a trip to Rome and Jerusalem. They called it the Pursuers of Peace Pilgrimage. Nobody thought it was the least bit remarkable. In recent weeks, when Cardinal Donald Worrell of Washington, Bishop Zubik's predecessor at the Diocese of Pittsburgh, came under fire in the church abuse scandal, some of the deepest expressions of sadness about his role came from Pittsburgh Jews who remembered him as a constant presence in their pews. And when, on this cursed Saturday morning, gunfire broke out in Tree of Life, just three blocks from my home, the Jewish rhythms that are a part of this city's beat seemed to take over the soundtrack of Pittsburgh. Hundreds gathered hours later at the corner of Murray and Forbes, where a clock tower with Hebrew letters has kept time for the Squirrel Hill neighborhood for a generation. There were, to be sure, rabbis in that crowd, but the vigil was dominated by students from nearby Taylor Alderdice High School. There was no debate in our offices of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, where for years the reporter Steve Levin, his gray beard drooping from his chin, his black cap sitting on his skull, wrote luminous tone poems. No debate about whether to describe Saturday's massacre as a hate crime. The man charged with perpetrating it, who in his own online biographic profile asserted that, here I quote, "Jews are the children of Satan," end quote, reportedly shouted anti-Semitic epithets as his gun choked bullets. Around here, angry shouts are reserved for the Cleveland Browns, bitter rivals to the north, but a team that traveled to Heinz Field for its Sunday confrontation that suddenly seemed to lose its urgency. In all of this, racing around town and then to the office to join my colleagues in chronicling this sad chapter in our histories, in the history of our city, I could not repress a line that the presidential chronicler, Teddy White, wrote in the commemorative edition of Life magazine in the sad days after the assassination of John Kennedy. One wished for a cry, a sob, a wail, any human sound. And during the day of Pittsburgh suffering, so many of us, not only Jews, Jews like me, wished for that cry or any human sound or perhaps even some shard of routine to ward off the certainty that the day was anything but routine. So now a confession on this time of surpassing sin. Amid all this, I dropped by my own house within the sound of the sirens and took the wet laundry out of the washer and placed it in the dryer. Something about cleanliness amid the sordidness made me need to do that. Later that night, my wife, a Polish Catholic from Buffalo, and I put those clean sheets on the bed. Cindy Skrzycki went from the nuns at St. Matthew's School at East Ferry in Wyoming, in Buffalo, to daily mass at Annunciation High School, and finally to the tutelage of the Jesuits at Canisius College. In classic Pittsburgh style, her daughter, our youngest, is a year from ordination as a rabbi. That daughter asked for a special moment of silence Monday morning at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. Our older daughter, Taylor Alderdice High School class of 2006, and now far away in San Francisco, sent this sober text: "I'm sleeping in my Pittsburgh shirt tonight." We all slept in our Pittsburgh shirts Saturday night, for there had been no shalom on Shabbat. I'm David Shribman. I'm the executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and a former New York Times political writer.
A separate editorial titled "Dispatch from Squirrel Hill, Dread in a Peaceful Place" was published in the Post-Gazette online Saturday. We'll link to them both online. I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence.
Rabbi Seth Adelson's cell phone has not stopped ringing since Saturday. He leads the congregation Beth Shalom in Squirrel Hill. With 600 families, it's one of the largest congregations in the city. In addition to handling the everyday needs of his congregants, he's also navigating their reactions to Saturday's mass shooting at Tree of Life Synagogue, where 11 worshipers were killed. He recently spoke with 90.5 WESA's Virginia Alvino Young.
Tell us a little bit about what your days are looking like this week.
I actually was just on the street by one of the hospitals. I had gone to visit a congregant, and a woman gets out of the car. She's, as I'm parking, she gets out and she says to me, "Are you Jewish?" She said, "Let me give you a hug." In addition to the outpouring of support, of course, I'm dealing with all of the things that you might imagine in terms of the fear, the anxiety, the concern about events that happened, and, you know, Rabbi, are we safe? Rabbi, what are we going to do to make sure our children are safe? Rabbi, what do I tell my kids? Rabbi, how do I respond to this? I feel very strongly that what's most important in times of crisis like this is community, that we have the ability to hold on to each other in the context of tragedy.
Well, Beth Shalom is one of the largest congregations in the city. What are you able to tell people, to offer them about how they can feel safer?
So in the context of loss, we always turn to not only to each other, but also to of the words of our tradition. Judaism is a tradition of words. So what we've done to help people engage with their grief and to help process it is we're using the Psalms, the traditional liturgy, Psalm 121, Esai inai el harim, me'ayin yavo ezri, I lift up my eyes to the mountains, from where will my help come? Psalm 130, Mima amakim karaticha Adonai, from the depths I call to you, O God. We use those texts to sing, to recite, to chant as a way of helping us understand that we're not alone, that we have the support of each other, that we have the support of God in times of need.
We've seen in the wake of this tragedy a lot of strength and resilience, but what is the grieving process going to look like for some of the community?
A rabbi is actually a teacher, and we have always found comfort and solace in the words of our tradition. I know that my job as a rabbi, though, is not only to teach, but also to bring comfort, and it's my job, in some sense, to help people find a vehicle for their grief. We, the Jews, provide space for grieving, and we do it by talking. One such example is that in the coming days you might hear, in the wake of the funerals that will probably fill much of the rest of the week, you will hear people talking about something called Shiva, or in Hebrew, Shiva. Shiva literally means seven. It's the seven-day mourning period after burial. And Shiva is an opportunity to let those who are grieving grieve, to give them the space for that, to talk through it. And we in Judaism, I feel like we really do death well. We're good at mourning rituals. We've got really the most powerful mourning rituals. And one of the things we do is we give space and acknowledge that when you've got a loss, when you've had a loss, you're entitled to grieve, and you're entitled to talk or not talk, and you're entitled to cry or not cry. We as a community want to help you find your way through this grief.
Is there anything that the national conversation is missing?
Synagogues, churches, mosques, Hindu temples are soft targets. We've had a number of attacks, and what we really need to do is to harden those targets, to make it harder for people to get in. And look, most congregations don't really have the money that you need to be able to make a synagogue impenetrable. But the other problem, the other challenge is that I don't want my synagogue to be impenetrable. I want it to be welcoming. I want people to come in. And yet the reality is that we need more.
That was Rabbi Seth Adelson of Beth Shalom speaking to WESA's Virginia Alvino Young. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Voters go to the polls a week from today. One of the interesting races is in Pennsylvania House District 39, which includes parts of Allegheny and Washington counties, and has been represented by Republican Rick Saccone since 2011. But after losing two congressional bids this year, Saccone is retiring, leaving the seat open to two hometown candidates. 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley reports the race has focused on taxes and spending.
Surrounded by large plastic pumpkins and American flags, Rob Roderick makes his way through piles of leaves along a quiet street in Greenock, Elizabeth Township. It's a chilly afternoon, and the Democratic candidate is having a difficult time finding human residents until he reaches one house with a furry greeter and its owner.
Oh, is he purdy.
I'll leave it on the door so not to get your dog. I'm running for state representative. My name's Rob Roderick, and there's a little bit about myself on the back of the card. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for taking a minute to say hello.
Roderick knows this area well. He's owned a chiropractic business here for 22 years and has held seats on the Elizabeth Forward School Board and Elizabeth Township Board of Commissioners. While serving as president of the board, he helped overhaul the township's failing sewage system, a project he says illustrates he can solve local issues.
I've made the tough votes. I've made, you know, I've been in that position because you have to do what's best for your residents, your district, and your area.
He says constituents in District 39 often ask him about school property taxes. He's an advocate for reform and wants to instead fund public schools with a tax on sales or natural gas drilling. Still, he says he doesn't want local communities to lose the revenue they already see from drilling.
I don't want to see that impact fee kind of go away. And I'm not against an extraction tax, but I would like to see both of them in place.
He says he'd also like to create legislation requiring elected officials to pay their own legal settlements instead of taxpayers. Roderick's been endorsed by familiar Democratic groups like teacher and labor unions, but he's also been backed by a number of Republicans in the region, including fellow commissioner and Elizabeth Township Republican Committee Chairman Andrew Kuzma.
He has common sense. He has business experience. He is financially and fiscally responsible. He's conservative, you know, when it comes to spending. He's conservative-minded.
The Pennsylvania Association of Realtors is also supporting Roderick. He says that backing was particularly notable, considering his opponent works for a real estate closing company.
It was one endorsement that I didn't think that I would ever have a chance, but they said, we really, you know, what you've done on a local level and your understanding and knowledge of what we need, we're on the same page.
His challenger is Mike Buscarek, a third-generation businessman with Matrix Property Settlements, who's never held elected office. He says people in the 39th district have watched other regions attract development and investment and feel like they've been forgotten.
And you saw places that, you know, saw growth, places like the North Hills, out west of the city, South Fayette. You know, those are areas that they're our neighbors and they're doing quite well, but we've never really seen that growth make its way over to the 39th district.
He'd also like to eliminate school property taxes and replace it with an increased sales or income tax. Working in real estate, he says he's seen families struggle to pay property taxes.
They're saying it's become unsustainable. They can't afford it.
He's endorsed by the abortion rights opponents LifePAC, several small business groups, and the gun rights group Firearm Owners Against Crime. FOAC's president, Kim Stolfer, says Puskarik's values align with his organization's legislative stance.
He understood that registration of firearms is not something that we should be doing. He recognized that it's failed everywhere it's been tried.
The district's former official representative, Republican Rick Saccone, hasn't officially endorsed either candidate, but he said in a message that the decision by Puskarik's campaign to print ads with false information about Roderick's budget was despicable. He says voters shouldn't choose based on political affiliation alone when they go to the polls on November 6th. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
It is the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Candidates have one more week to make their cases to voters before the November 6th election. What might happen in this final week of campaigning? Any surprises? Well, let's find out from WESA's Chris Potter, the leader of our politics and government accountability team. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Kevin.
So, Chris, we have contests for governor, U.S. Senate, 18 congressional seats, but I'd like to start down the ballot first, and a race that's brought in some outside money, some misleading yard signs, and legal challenges to the 38th State Senate District. Remind us, what area is covered by the 38th?
So you're a man after my own heart, starting down ballot, Kevin. So the 38th State Senate District includes a bit of the east end of Pittsburgh, but it's mostly suburbs north of the rivers. So we're talking some of the riverfront communities, Millvale, places like that, and then going on up into the North Hills, some of the more prosperous suburbs. This is a district that used to be represented by Randy Volokovich, who was beat in the Republican Party by a more sort of an upstart, more conservative challenger, Jeremy Schaefer, and Schaefer is now facing Democrat Lindsey Williams.
So Schaefer, or at least his supporters, are trying to paint Williams as a socialist, and are also challenging her residency. Any sense that that strategy is working?
You know, it's not worked in the sense that there was a legal challenge to her residency, and it really boils down to, where did Lindsey Williams live for a period of a few weeks 4 years ago? The state constitution says that if you're going to run for state senator, you have to have been a resident of the state of Pennsylvania for 4 years prior to your election. And there's evidence to suggest Lindsey Williams was in the process of moving from Maryland at that time. And there's some question as to whether she actually lived in Pennsylvania on Election Day 2014. There's no question that she lived in Pennsylvania in December, just a month later. But there's still this question about the timing. A judge threw that challenge out. So in that sense, it has not been successful. And the judge threw that out because Republicans had waited too long to file it. They waited until just a couple weeks before the election, and there's state law that says if you're going to challenge somebody's petitions, it has to be within days of their being filed. However, there's always the sense that these are sort of politically motivated suits, or at least that they have a political dimension. And it remains to be seen, have these charges of socialism hurt her with voters? And I don't know that we've seen evidence of that yet, because I just haven't seen polling, but it is possible. This has been a very spirited, close-fought race, and it is possible that that will make a difference.
So some money has come in support of Williams and attacking Schaefer, especially over his stance on education funding. So where's that money coming from?
So we will be having some reporting on this a little later today. But yes, there is an organization called the Pennsylvania Fund for Change, which has been active across the state, and particularly in the eastern part of the state. But it has, in Allegheny County, been sending out a lot of mailers faulting Mr. Schaefer for his position on education. He says mischaracterizing that position. It's also attacked a state House candidate, a Republican state House candidate, Lori Mizgorski, who's running in the same district. So it's kind of a two for one. These are mailings that kind of single out both these candidates.
So the 30th House district is encompassed by the larger 38th senatorial district.
Just so, that's correct.
Okay. So why is outside money coming in for a state legislative race?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big question. And we should say, just in terms of the candidates themselves, this is a very expensive race right now. Both Mr. Schaefer and Ms. Williams, when they turned in campaign finance reports at the end of last week, had raised more than $700,000. $100,000 between June and October here. So they're spending a lot of money. But I do think what we're seeing here is a percolating down of some of the big money super PAC type groups spending money. They've been doing it at the congressional level, and now that approach is trickling down to the state and local level.
All right. Let's move up ballot now.
Sure.
Governor, Senate, not too much polling there either.
Yeah, I think that generally within sort of the political class, and I would say within both parties, there's a sense here that the Democratic incumbents are in a very solid position. Donald Trump just yesterday announced that he was visiting several states between now and Election Day. Pennsylvania is not on that list. He has done what he's going to do for those candidates. And I think in general, you just haven't seen national interest in those races. The campaign, the financial reports for Scott Wagner again last week, not a lot of money coming his way right up until the end here. Governor Wolf has been out fundraising him, and we just aren't seeing a lot of movement.
All right. Very briefly now, a couple of things. 18 congressional seats, U.S. House seats up for grabs. Give me one interesting race that you're could be a surprise.
I think if there was a surprise in the West, it would be the 16th congressional district. This is Ron DeNicola, the Democrat, running against Mike Kelly, who's sort of the incumbent in the 3rd congressional district.
So that's part of Butler County on up?
All the way up to Erie. And this is again, a case where the district was redrawn by the state Supreme Court, and it is more advantageous to Democrats. It's still, I would say, if I were putting money on it, I'd put money on Mike Kelly, but if there's a potential for a surprise, that would be it.
Two quick final questions for you. So any idea how are the events in Squirrel Hill affecting races around the region? Has there been any change in tone or message from candidates around the state or in Western Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I know, for example, Governor Tom Wolf has pulled his advertising from the market in recent days. Not all the candidates have done that. I've still seen ads for both of the candidates in the state Senate 38th, including Jeremy Schaefer with an attack ad on Lindsey Williams, and Lindsey Williams with just sort of a here's who I am kind of spot. Guy Reschenthaler, who's running in the 14th congressional district, still has ads up touting his own record here. So I think, typically here what we see is people kind of backing off a little bit. The big, of course, the question now is we have Donald Trump coming in here today. What effect that'll have?
Well, let's talk very briefly the last minute we have with you. He's in town this afternoon. Anything to look for from the president's visit, either political or what messaging can we expect? Because we've heard two different kind of messages from the president.
Right now, I think it's closed press as far as there will be press pool with him. But this is not a rally. We should be careful to say he apparently will. There's reason to believe, nothing's been confirmed by the White House, but there's reason to believe he'll be visiting a hospital, perhaps the Tree of Life, the site of the synagogue itself. There will likely be some sort of protest, and there's sort of a spirited debate. We'll be reporting something on this shortly. There's sort of a spirited debate among Democrats. Should we even protest this? Does protesting this president give him the kind of optics that he wants to fire up his base? And that's where we are. Everything now becomes grist for this mill of politics and division a week ahead of this election.
WESA's Chris Potter is the leader of our politics and government accountability team. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was produced and engineered by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a peaceful day.